You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more. Today on our show, we're talking with Dan Price. He's in Carlsbad, California. I think he's in his car at the top of a hill. Dan, thanks so much for being with me today.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Good, good. So to begin with, I want to talk to you about photography, writing, you know, your books and other things. But what are you doing right now? I know you go on kind of these adventures and stuff. So what's happening this year and what's your current kind of adventure and situation?
Yeah, I'm kind of retired. I'm 58 years old and spent a lot of years doing artwork and writing books and picked up surfing about 6 years ago and spent five winters in Hawaii learning how to surf. And so this year I'm going down the California coast, living in a van and surfing every day and playing some music on the streets to make some gas money.
And what instruments do you play? What exactly are you playing on the streets?
It's a steel drum called a handpan and a relatively new instrument. It was invented in the year 2000 where they enclosed a steel drum. It looks like a little UFO and it sits in your lap and it makes just a beautiful sound. And so I'll just sit on a street and play it and put the little bowl out in front of me and make a little gas money. It's really fun.
That sounds great. And so you're just playing. You're not singing as well, right? It's just the instrument?
Right. I don't sing, nope.
And are you traveling with other friends or partners or family?
Yeah, I'm with my wife for a month, but I am on the road for 4 months this winter. Going to go back at the end of March. November, December, January, February, March. Be 5 months on the road this winter. And then go back to my little Hobbit Hole house back in Oregon.
And when you're back in Oregon in your Hobbit Hole house, what happens there during the, I guess that's the summers? What do you do there to either work or make money?
Yeah, it is a 6 month stint there in Eastern Oregon. It's a mountain town, and I have been in a little meadow for 25 years. Building different kinds of little simple structures. Simple living is kind of one of my big hobbies, kind of my religion, sort of. I lived in teepees, huts, tiny little wooden beach-type shacks, and now I live in a little underground room. It's 80 square feet, meaning it's 8 foot across, and about 4 feet high, and it's sunk into a hillside with a little skylight. There's been a lot of YouTube videos about it. And I just go there and hike and play the drums and do some odd jobs for people during the summer to make a little money. But because my life is so incredibly simple, I don't have mortgages, car payments, I'm not in debt, I don't like to buy things. So that's what enables me to just play music and kind of chill out, do an odd job here and there, and then take the winter off and go do something really neat like surfing.
I love that. Of course, that's kind of a life that I aspire to or would like to. And you also have a family, right? A wife and kids or no?
Yeah, we raised two children. They're now in their early 30s, and I spend a lot of time with my partner, my wife, ex-wife, not sure how to say it.
That's okay.
We're not married, but we spend a lot of time together, and we're traveling right now and having a great month together down here.
And so she's also kind of having this this simple life with you, right? She's you're both on this as one of your books is called, the kind of radical simplicity in terms of lifestyle?
No. She has a house, a simple house, but a regular house and a regular job. And I kind of went the opposite direction and decided to start living in a teepee. And when we got divorced, and But we've always helped raise the kids together and spent a ton of time together, never remarried or anything. But it's interesting because she does have a regular house about 6 miles from where I live. And she'll come up and climb in the sweat lodge or go hiking or running. And I'll go down there. They have the occasional regular meal. But the way I do things is extremely simplified. Even the way I eat, I don't have running water. I do have electricity. I do use the internet and cell phones. But I just, my life is really, really boiled down. Yeah, it's kind of to a radical simplicity. That's what that book was called. And that's, I just love living that way. I get confused and if things start getting too complicated.
And how do you eat? So maybe you can just like run me through a day in you know, Oregon or you know, a teepee when you are. Like what do you eat and what happens then during a typical day of living, you know, this simple life, as you put it.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. Here we are in Southern California where we're trying to go do internet in the coffee shops, and they're so noisy, we just can't hardly deal with it. We're just used to, you know, we live in a town of 1,500 people. There's no stoplights. I mean, it's people in big cities would think that we live in paradise. We live right next to a wilderness and a lake and a beautiful, you know, mountain range. We can hike in 5 minutes anywhere we want in a wilderness. It's pretty ideal. And so my day, I wake up, I don't run off to work. I wake up when I want, usually quite early, 5 a.m. And I'll go out and fill my shower bucket, which is a manual shower that's filled with a bucket from the river, and you flip a switch and it heats up in about half an hour. I'll go back in the hobbit hole, take vitamins, have some really good cereal mixes that I make, and eat some dried fruit. I mean, all the food that I eat is really healthy. There's no junk food. And do my stretches after I eat, like about 15 minutes of yoga type stretches. Go down, take a shower, and so by about 9, my day starts. And who knows what I might do? I might be building a little project. I might. It's all serendipitous. I mean, I don't have a plan usually. I might sit there for 2 hours on my little patio, and which people can see in those YouTube videos on my website, and play the drum for a couple hours. And all of a sudden you look up and it's lunchtime. Lunchtime might be just cheese and crackers, a little more fruit, a little bread, water. I filter water out of the river, and water is really the only liquid I drink. I mean, I'll drink tea once in a while, but I don't do coffee. I don't do booze. I don't do juice. I just drink water all the time. And then supper is another kind of mellow affair with just a simple can of soup or a sandwich, or I don't cook very often. The one meal that I do make that is kind of sustaining me is rice with some kind of beans and vegetables, and that's something that I can kind of keep going for a few days at a time and finish off that pot and wash it up. I have one copper pot I cook in, and that meal will sustain me for a couple days, and then I'll let it go, wash the pot and let it go for half a week, and then start mixing it up again and cooking up some more of that. That's sort of the base meal that I live off.
And you're also writing, right? I mean, you've written several books, and these are available as ebooks. But in terms of your life and serendipity, you're also pursuing text, the Moonlight Chronicles, as you call them. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, the Moonlight Chronicles zine, a personal magazine, ran from 1992 to 2012. I think it's 20 years. I did 77 issues. They were 100 pages each. Before that, in 1980, I became a news photographer, and I just wasn't the kind of news photographer to just take the assignment and do the assignment and go home. I just was, everything that I do, I tend to do with a huge passion and go deep. And photography, I went really deep. I became a news photographer because I really wanted to photograph small town America, which I got to do in a bunch of different states. But that also opened up a world for me of a dark room and a bunch of free film and paper. And I just photographed extensively for 10 years, tried towards the end to get on with Magnum Photos, which is a premier photo agency, almost got on with them, did fine art photography and had shows. I've had shows in Europe and America with the fine art photography. So I was doing photojournalism, fine art photography, trying to get on with a photo agency. Actually got on with Alliance Photos, which was an offshoot of Magnum, for a few years. But in the mix of all that, so that was between 1980 and 1990. In the middle of that, in 1986, I created a photo magazine called Shots, which is still going today. You can look at shotsmagazine.com. But I ran it for 47 issues and basically requested people around the world to send me black and white photographs, kind of their personal photo projects. And how it really started was I met a lot of news photographers who were in the daily grind, and they kind of hated it because it was just assignment photography. But on the side, they had all this wonderful personal photo projects that they were working on. I thought, I'm going to create a magazine and get those personal photo projects published. And I did that and just published thousands of pictures for about 10 years. I ran that and did 47 issues.
So I want to talk about that a little bit, because yeah, that's something I know. I received Shots Magazine. I subscribed to that, and I remember it well. It was a newsprint, issue, and, you opened it up and even printed on newsprint. I mean, and really, photographs arguably looked pretty lousy on newsprint. But in Shots Magazine, they looked beautiful. There was still something, like, stunning. I was running a gallery then. I was also living in a very remote area, Block Island, and into zines and mail art. And I would look at these and think, my God, these are gorgeous. That's how I got introduced to also the Diana Camera and a number of other things that you devoted issues to. And I also remember, they were all handwritten. And I loved that because I was into kind of manuscript writing then. And they were very personal, and we're talking about things that you were doing and your kids and all kinds of stuff. And I remember also there were different responses from readers. Some people didn't want to hear all this personal stuff. And one issue that I remember that was just funny to me was you said, for those readers who don't want to hear my personal stuff, you might want to skip to page, 25 or something. And I also remember at that time, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but there were some people who said, I don't believe you're having a written dialogue with Robert Frank. And you said, just for those people, here's all my letters. And you reproduced all the letters. That was great, right?
Yeah.
So that's pretty exciting. And that was a rich experience. And I followed you until I think shortly after that, when it seemed that there was like a gig going with a sneaker company too, and the whole Simple Life thing started. But to talk a little bit more about Shots Magazine, and the reason I'm also talking about this is I was interviewing somebody this morning who was in London, a critic who's written books on photography and art and what is photography and what isn't. And I said, do you know Shots Magazine? And she said maybe she knew it, but then I thought, God, I have to see what you're doing now. So that magazine seemed to me, which is more like a zine, printed on newsprint, obviously inexpensive. Your images were still engaging, riveting, fascinating somehow in that format, as well as others. At that time, it seems you were building up like a kind of big following of your own, as well as something that kind of launched your career. Is that correct?
Well, first of all, I agree with everything you said about Shots, and I think what made it unique was that it had no pretension at all. It wasn't slick, and I would actually publish people's handwritten letters. I would just Xerox their letters and put them right in there. So it was really cool because you saw how everyone had different handwriting, and it was just so fun to just do a magazine exactly the way I wanted. I didn't have any other editors bothering me. What happened at the very end of that is I started putting my own personal, I started drawing towards the end of my photo career. And I started putting those drawings in a little section of shots and saying, well, this is a kind of my own personal stuff here, some more, read it if you want. That actually turned into another magazine called Moonlight Chronicles, and I started doing that. It was just drawing. I got really tired of being in a dark room and dealing with all the chemicals. When I left Kentucky, my last newspaper job, in 1990, and went back to Oregon, kind of our home state, I quit photography entirely. It took a couple of years to get out of it, but I quit it entirely, quit taking pictures, didn't do any darkroom work anymore, and was drawing with a pen and ink and making these little journals about all the adventures I was having and raising children and starting to create the simple life, living in a teepee and stuff in Oregon. That became a magazine called Moonlight Chronicles. After about a year or two of publishing that, in a very small way, maybe 100 subscribers, Shots Magazine had a total of 1,750 subscribers, which really bummed me out. But Bill Jay, a big writer on photography, I used to publish some of his, he used to have a column in Shots. He said, no, Dan, that's actually really good because the photo community in fine art is about 2,500 people. He said, if you have 1,750 of them subscribed to Shots, that's really good. And so that made me feel good. But I got into doing the Moonlight Chronicles, developed about 100 subscribers, and then I was going to do a walk across Oregon. I started doing all these radical things. I sold my car, said I'm going to live totally simple, and I sold my car on the west coast of Oregon where my family was, my kids, and walked home across the state. And I put all that story in my little Moonlight Chronicle magazine, and a shoe company, I wrote them and said, I need a pair of your shoes. Would you give them to me? And it was a new sneaker company called Simple Shoes out of Santa Barbara. And he sent me a pair of his little boots. I wrote about them in that issue and then kind of and said thank you to him at the end of the trip. And then a few months later, he called me and said, dude, we've been looking for you. We want to hook up with you. We really love your magazine. And what they did was they turned my magazine into their shoe catalog, but basically I just kept doing my illustrated travel journals, and then they would put their little shoes in the back and use that as a catalog. It was a really unique way to do a shoe catalog. No one had ever done that before, and they paid me. And that relationship went on for 8 years, and is one of the reasons why I'm kind of retired now, because I got paid good, and I basically went around the world just doing my personal illustrated journals, if you can imagine. It was an incredible once in a million opportunity for an artist.
And the Shots magazine obviously kind of went on. Other people published it, but that was also I understand your interest changed. But as you were just about to talk about the mailing list, I thought you almost said there was something unfortunate that happened there. Maybe I misheard you, but that was kind of a big following that you had that was specific to the photographic world. And did that transfer over to the Moonlight Chronicles and the catalog or no?
A little bit. And I had people who followed me through Shots, such as yourself, and they never did stop following me all the way through 77 issues of Moonlight Chronicles 20 years later. So I basically did 30 years of publishing these two different magazines. And, I probably had a cult following, in a sense. I've had a web presence for about 15 years. I think I have way more of a following now. But what is transferred in? So anyway, the Moonlight Chronicles went from my little 100 subscribers to when Simple picked me up, they started paying me a salary per month. I didn't worry about subscribers anymore. I fulfilled those subscribers' orders. And I think at one time I had about 300 people subscribing. But I didn't really push subscriptions anymore. I was being paid by Simple And they published, I went from printing, hand printing 100 Moonlight Chronicles to them printing between 30 and 50,000 copies that they just sent all over the world. So there really was no point in me worrying about subscriptions. And so I just kind of let that go. And it just kind of whittled down to nothing. And in 1990, I also started the Simple Life Project in this meadow and built all these different structures, teepees, huts, and now the underground room and a little underground studio, and basically spent the last 25 years figuring out how to live ultra simple so I could be free to do the artwork or surfing or drawing or whatever I wanted to do, and it's worked out really great. But as far as the following, now what's happened through, you know, the tiny house movement's really huge right now, and I've had a lot of YouTube-type videos done on that people will come. I was on one year. The quick story is in 2012, NBC.com got a hold of me and said, "We want to come and photograph your place." I go, "Sure." They came, spent a few days taking still pictures, put it up on NBC.com, and it started trending on Yahoo. Well, when something trends like that, all the major news agencies kind of go, "Whoa, look at this shit that's trending. We need to do a story on that." And it was kind of about this guy that lives on $5,000 or less. It was a big deal. There was a new Hobbit movie out. And so I was visited by Inside Edition. That's the biggest American news magazine. They came and did a piece. I had a Canadian crew that was wanting to come, but I was heading off to Hawaii and said, "No, there's no time," and had an Australian crew come and do a TV piece. That Australian YouTube has 307,000 views, and just recently a tiny house videographer named Kirsten Dirksen out of Spain, who goes all over the world photographing people where their tiny houses came, did a piece this last summer, and that sucker is just going. It has like 250,000 views, and what's so cool about it is the 500-some comments on it. Unlike some of the other YouTube videos where the haters got on there and got all weird on me, her comments, 95% of them are incredibly positive. And it's so cool to go click on a few comments and people, "Oh, that guy's got it wired right on." So that's kind of what's happened recently.
Well, that's exciting. So in closing, there'll be links in this article to some of those videos and moonlightchronicles.com. But you're also on, I mean, as a photographer, to bring it around there, and an artist and a traveler, you're also using Instagram now, right? That's something that seems to be also a photographic medium that you're using again?
Yeah, and I was on YouTube for a couple of years, and I was on Flickr for a couple of years, and I was putting way too much of my art, because I do paintings, and I have a ton of photography, and I'm going, "Hold it, why am I throwing that all up there?" And here I am doing it again on Instagram, but it's just my nature to share, and I've written all these different books, and it's just cool to share. I got a little scared about YouTube and Flickr, Facebook and Flickr, reading what might happen in 5 or 10 years with it. It just kind of spooked me out, thinking, "Hold, I'm putting all my artwork up there. Anyone could just pull it off and make a T-shirt out of it, and that's not right." So I shut all that down, went quiet for a few months, and then discovered Instagram. Well, Instagram's so cool. You know, you can get into your groups of people, and of course what I'm into is the handpan music and seeing what people are doing all over the world. So that's been really exciting, and it's also an education for me, because I get to go see what people are doing. I'm trying to dig deep into that community. So I've done photography deep, simple life deep, surfing deep. I mean, the surfing thing was really intense, and now this handpan thing is really intense, because I just go deep and try and learn all about it and become one of the players, and that's what I'm where I'm at right now.
Then you were talking about when you met Robert Frank. I was referencing, you know, the time that you printed those in shots. So just in closing, because we spoke about this a little bit off the record, you were saying you were in New York, and it was years after Robert Frank had written you handwritten letters. And what happened?
Yeah, I'm walking around in Bleecker Street, and I find a doorway. I just happened to look at the doorway, and I realized that was his address in New York City where I used to send Shots Magazine. And I knocked on the door, and he opened the door. And I was, like, in shock. I mean, he was totally my hero, my mentor. And I told him who I was, and he let me in. And I didn't have a camera with me. There was no way to record me meeting Robert Frank, which is a real bummer. I wasn't going to ask him, hey, can we make a selfie, right? And so I didn't do that. But I went in and sat down with him. June Leaf, his wife, was in there in this kind of really strange, dark, dumpy apartment. And we sat down and talked. And it was, of course, really odd. He's a really odd fella. But I said, Robert, I just have to say something. I want to apologize to you for publishing those letters that you sent me in Shots Magazine. And he kind of looked at me, and I think he didn't really know what I was talking about. But he got Shots Magazine. He was a lifetime member. He got every issue. I'm sure he saw those letters in there. And guess what happened? After I published those, never got another letter from Robert Frank again. He did put one of my pictures in one of his books about postcards, so I apologized to him. I said, man, I really shouldn't have done that. Those were our personal letters, and he just kind of waved his hand in the air and dismissed it. But that was amazing to meet him, and I would have done anything to have a picture of him with me, much like my winner on the North Shore of Oahu surfing on an iconic wave, and I got to sit with the best surfer in the world, Kelly Slater, on the back of his van and snap a picture of him, sitting with him and me together. It was like, it was the same kind of a thing.
That's great. I'm so glad you told that story. Well, Dan, it's been great talking to you. I'm really glad you spent this time with me, and I just want to thank you for your time today.
Well, I appreciate your interest. Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.